are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 20th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sam Bagenstos, professor of law from the University of Michigan, on the Civil Rights Division Deja Vu, only worse. Also on the program today, Tea Party debt truther Mick Mulvaney, now in charge of the budget. Also, President Electoral has some of the worst post-election approval ratings ever. And Trump appoints a morally bankrupt bankruptcy attorney as ambassador to Israel. Klepto watch. The Kuwaiti delegation reveals hotel pressure. And Uday and Kusei have a fascinating pay-to-play scheme available to you for a cool $1 million. States, meanwhile, across the country now assaulting the minimum wage. The EPA concludes that fracking has indeed contaminated drinking water. And that Chinese drone skirmish was over before Donald Trump even was quick enough to send off his first tweet.
Unprecedented. Miss.
Don't misunderestimate. Misagination.
Don't misaggregate me.
Strategery. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We are nearing the end of 2016. It did not end well, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. 2017 is going to be rough, but we're going to be fighting in the trenches, as it were. I mean, not literal. Probably we'll have to wait till 2018 for that.
Yeah, 18th trenches. That's right.
If all goes well, we won't be fighting in actual trenches until 2018.
Some time to train.
Exactly.
Join me at yoga, guys.
Yesterday, as you know, was the day that the electors were coming to issue their final votes, or I should say their first votes. And there was a tiny bit of hope. Highly unlikely that there would be enough faithless electors to prevent President Electoral Mr. Donald Trump from becoming the president of the United States. As you know, he lost by nearly 3 million votes. Stunning number of votes. And that's not adding up the tally of everybody who voted against him. There was a lot more than 3 million. I think probably closer to like 6 or 7 million who voted against him.
But if you subtract all the people that voted for Hillary, I won by a huge margin.
That's right.
Think about it.
And there were a historic number of electors who ended up being faithless electors. However, most of them were supposed to vote for Clinton, and some of them voted for Colin Powell, I think as an attempt. They were hoping to swing other electors to vote for Colin Powell. I'm not sure. They wanted to seem nonpartisan, I guess. One voted for Faith Spotted Eagle, a Native American leader. Another Democratic elector in Hawaii voted for Bernie Sanders. Two Texas electors voted for different Republican politicians than they were supposed to, Governor John Kasich and Ron Paul. Three other Democratic electors in Colorado, Maine, and Minnesota initially declined to vote for Mrs. Clinton. Two were replaced by an alternate, and one ended up changing his vote. So, at the very least, it undercuts the premise of the Electoral College. And if we're ever in a position where saner voices are in control, hopefully that will be job number one, get rid of the Electoral College. Again, the other way is for the National Vote, Popular Vote Compact. But here is a video from the Salt Lake Tribune. Representative Robert Gehrke, the Utah State Capitol yesterday, shaming the Electoral College.
That's reporter. This is the guy who tweeted the video. Reporter, that was not representative.
Oh, I'm sorry. Reporter Robert Gehrke, shaming the Electoral College voters for voting for Trump. Here is that. And remember, this is Utah now where, you know, they where McMullen ran and there was some hesitation to vote for someone so just personally nasty. There's a little kid there, too. And there was one woman, a protest I've seen video of in Wisconsin also, similarly admonishing electors. And, you know, look, there's a lot of bad things that I think are going to happen under Trump, some of which will be predictable. In fact, Sam Bagginsos will be here to tell us one of those things. We could also get, you know, into where those things are sort of the best case scenario, frankly. You know, you see situations like that. I mean, I keep citing this to people, that moment where the CEO of Time Warner was, I'm not worried about Donald Trump and the First Amendment. I'm more worried about the Democrats with Citizens United, which, of course, you know, is, if he believes this, he's a moron. But more likely, he's smart enough to know that with a $6 billion potential merger in the works, I've got to kiss the king's ass. And that's the, I mean, that's really the danger here, is that we're starting to see this. I have heard a report, and I have not been able to follow up on it, but the report is, let's just look at it as a hypothetical. Hypothetically, what could happen is you could have the administration say to an administrative agency, request all, you know, have the inspector general of these administrative agencies, like the EPA, for instance, we want any correspondence amongst EPA staffers that mention the word Trump over the past 6 months. I want to see all those. And that's the way they could purge different agencies or punish people. So all that and more is ahead. And it's going to be important that people stay engaged. We'll talk more about this over the next couple of days before we go. One of the things we're also going to need is to occasionally laugh, maybe more often than not. And aside from, you know, in those days where Michael's off by a little bit, can't every day can't be a gem, you have CISO, spelled S-E-E-S-O. It's the new ad-free streaming service bringing you hilarious original series. And not just original series, you get handpicked classics, weeks of stand-up specials, more. If you're a fan of comedy, folks, or if you're a cord cutter, because you can see every episode of SNL ever, including new episodes the day after they air. It's always much better. I'm not going to stay up until 11:30 to watch that show. The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon. The Late Night Show with Seth Meyers the day after they air. And they have classics like 30 Rock, Parks and Rec, Saved by the Bell, even. British comedies, like the original Office with Ricky Gervais, one of my favorite. The Monty Python catalog. I'm very close to introducing Mila to this. The IT Crowd, Steve Coogan. If you've never seen Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge, you're missing something. And then you can watch the icons before they made it big. Louis C.K., Hannibal Buress, Chelsea Peretti, Amy Schumer, all of this stand-up specials. Right now, my listeners can try CISO for free. What? For free? You got to be kidding me. That's exactly what I need. I need a comedy, and I need it for free. For 2 months, use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Shows you can't get anywhere else. Plus, they have a critically acclaimed original series like Take My Wife or Harmon Quest. My favorite, Hidden America with Joan and Ray. I'm also interested in seeing. They got bajillion-dollar properties. I don't know. Some of the guys from Reno 911 and Comedy Bang Bang, those are both good shows. So, just go to CISO, CISO.com right now to sign up for 2 months free with promo code MAJORITY at checkout. That's CISO.com, promo code MAJORITY. Folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sam Bagenstos, professor of law at the University of Michigan, former assistant attorney general. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Sam Bagenstos, he is the professor of law at University of Michigan and writer of the piece in prospect.org, Civil Rights Deja Vu, Only Worse. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's start with just your background, because the dynamic that you describe broadly in the piece, and then I want to get to the specifics, but the dynamic you describe broadly is one that during the Bush administration, I was constantly, was a constant source of debate. Like how much damage are they doing to these different agencies? How long will it take to repair these things? And I know from agency to agency, it's not, obviously there's unique differences, but I think broadly speaking, you give us a sense of that. So just give us a little bit of your background. So from what your sort of from how you're making these assessments.
Sure. So I have spent most of my professional career, at least in part, as a civil rights lawyer. So my first job as a practicing lawyer was as part of the career civil service in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. And so I had an opportunity to see the importance of the career staff and the career professionals there. And then at the beginning of the Obama administration, I came back to the Civil Rights Division as part of the political leadership team, trying to rebuild the division after what had happened during the Bush years, which gave me a chance to see what an administration that is out to destroy civil rights enforcement can do, as the Bush administration tried to do, and then what it takes to rebuild, as we tried to do in the Obama administration. And I worry that we're about to see a similar cycle starting again.
So in the mid-90s, you were there as a as you were hired as a lawyer, but you came back under the Bush the Obama administration as a political appointee who was going to sort of rebuild this this agency. I mean, before we get into, you know, how they went about systemically pulling apart this division of the Department of Justice, I mean, do you have a sense, and I imagine this is less of an academic sense, but more of one just by knowing people in similarly positioned, how similar your perspective on this, on what was happening in the Civil Rights Division, was relative to other agencies? Because when we see someone like Pruitt, head of the EPA, who seems to be put in there specifically to dismantle their agency, I mean, there seems to be multiple examples of this.
Yeah, no, I think it's a playbook that folks who want to destroy the good stuff government can do can, you know, use all over the government. The Civil Rights Division has always been kind of a central flashpoint. You know, it's a place where if they're going to do this kind of thing anywhere, they're going to do it there. But, you know, in the Bush administration, you had in EPA, maybe for the first part of the administration, a little bit less of that because Christy Whitman, a relatively moderate right. head, had been appointed. But I think one of the things that we're worried about with the Trump administration is it seems that every agency head who gets announced is more right-wing, more extreme than the last. And so we're not going to have any of the Christy Whitmans. It's pretty much going to be the playbook the Bush administration used on the Civil Rights Division everywhere in the government.
All right. So give us a sense of just like how, when I mean, as far as you can tell, I mean, some of the stuff that you wrote about how shell-shocked the attorneys were after 8 years of Bush was pretty stunning. Just give us a sense of just sort of the personnel, you know, like who they put in, who stays, and what happens to those who stay. Because it's just so weird to me. It's just hard for me to imagine the idea of like taking a job to undermine the enterprise that you've just taken a job with.
I think that's right. It is sort of difficult to fathom. So I think the important background fact, I mean, you think about the Civil Rights Division, it's not that different than a lot of other government agencies. So there are about, depending on when you're talking about, you know, 500, 600, 700 people who work there, about half of them are lawyers. Nearly all of the staff are career civil servants. So they're not people who are supposed to come and go with the administration. They're people who are supposed to be selected based on their professional qualifications through a non-political process, carrying out the mission of the agency. And then there's a top layer of, you know, a few people, really, you know, a dozen or so people, maybe less, who are political appointees who owe their jobs to the incumbent administration and come with it and leave with it. And what happened during the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, is a group of political appointees came in who were just who had a very clear agenda of trying to destroy the effectiveness of the Civil Rights Division and try to subvert it. They didn't believe in the work of the division. They didn't believe in enforcing voting rights. They were very concerned with this sort of phantom of voter fraud. And so they wanted to undermine voting rights enforcement. They weren't particularly concerned with employment discrimination or housing discrimination. They were particularly worried that the Civil Rights Division had extended too far in trying to attack kind of subtle and modern forms of bias, and so they came in and you know they recognized that the big obstacle to making the radical changes they wanted were the professional career civil servants who were there to carry out the mission of the organization as created by Congress. And so they did a number of things. I mean, you know, they made life really, really difficult for people who worked there, transferring people to without warning to jobs where they were basically doing nothing, basically to try to make it such that people would find it intolerable and would leave, you know, being very personally abusive to a number of the staff. I mean, one of the things is so we found that during the course of the 8 years of the George W. Bush administration, a very large percentage of the career staff left. And particularly, you know, not surprisingly, it was disproportionately the lawyers who had, you know, a decent amount of experience, like 7 to 15 years of experience. The statistic that we often saw was between, I think, 2002 and 2006, the voting section, the sort of crucial section of the Civil Rights Division, lost 2/3 of its attorneys. And they were disproportionately the folks who, you know, had a lot of experience who you would rely on to handle the most important and sensitive matters. And they were replaced in a process that the Office of Inspector General and Office of Public Responsibility found later to be improperly politicized. They were replaced
you
by
know,
people.
I remember now reading stories about this during, this is all coming back to me, sadly, as we talk, where they would bring in people from like Oral Roberts University or something like that. And it was all, there was a lot of, I remember reading about some of the interviews that had to do with just simply, there was a lot of Christ talk, with all due respect to followers of Christ here. It was, which was odd, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that what happened was there was definitely an effort that people made, who the Bush administration political appointees made, to try to turn the Civil Rights Division into a place where young conservative lawyers can go. And I'll say, look, you know, some of those lawyers, they came in, they were good, they knew what they were doing, and when a new administration came in, they were willing to carry out what the new administration had set as priorities. But a number of the folks were either folks who really couldn't get a job anywhere else. They were not of a quality to get really good jobs doing really important legal work. Or even worse, they were folks who were out to undermine the goals of the division. They were out to undermine voting rights enforcement. They were out to subvert the traditional work of the division. And those folks, you know, so when the Obama administration came in, you know, these are folks who have civil service protection. Some of them, as I said, you know, actually did quite good work. But many of them, either they just weren't capable of doing the kind of aggressive and important and complex work that you need to do, or they were really, you know, an internal fifth column. They were actively working to undermine what the new administration was trying to do in carrying out the laws that Congress had passed. And, you know, that was a legacy that the George W. Bush people knew that they were providing to the next administration. You know, this was not something that they just happened into. I mean, this was a very clear strategy.
All right. I want to get back to that legacy and how long it took to sort of how long it takes to sort of get past that legacy, I guess. But before we do, I want to remind people that one of the big controversies, or I don't know, maybe that's even too soft of a word. There was questions of the Hatch Act, I believe. The mass firing of AUSAs around the country, the politicization of the attorney generals U.S. attorneys in different states came out of that notion of voter fraud, right? I mean, so guys like Hans von Spassky, I can't pronounce his name, but
Spakovsky, yeah.
Yes, Spakovsky. He was, I remember, testifying quite a bit at that time and was sort of instrumental in making, you know, giving the predicate to fire some of these U.S. attorneys. Is that right?
Right. I mean, so this was all very closely connected. So the U.S. attorney scandal was, you know, when when the top level political staff at the Justice Department in the Bush administration put a lot of pressure on the U.S. attorneys, who are the people who represent the Department of Justice around the country, put a lot of pressure on the U.S. attorneys to go out and find cases of voter fraud and prosecute cases of voter fraud, because they had created, von Spakovsky and others had created, this narrative that there were all these people who were voting fraudulently. And of course, these people were people who were, you know, supposed to be members of minority groups, people in urban areas, people who vote Democratic, and they were all voting fraudulently, was the narrative. And so the message went out to the U.S. attorneys, go out and bring these cases to kind of prove up the narrative. And they couldn't find cases, right? Because voter fraud is something that happens in America, but extremely, extremely rarely. And the kind of voter fraud that happens is basically almost never the kind of voter fraud that folks like Hans von Spakovsky are trying to attack with things like voter ID laws. And so these U.S. attorneys, who were all political appointees of the Bush administration, you know, these are not, you know, liberals. These are folks who are Republican political appointees, went out and said, I can't find the cases. The cases don't exist. And the line came down from the politicals in the Justice Department and Maine Justice and in the White House. Well, then we'll find some new U.S. attorneys who will bring these cases, right? And that became a major scandal, because you're not supposed to politicize prosecution. And that was very closely tied in. And again, you know, the Office of Inspector General and Office of Professional Responsibility at DOJ issued a number of reports finding this, that was very connected with the politicization of the Civil Rights Division, of hiring in the Civil Rights Division, of efforts to try to purge voter rolls instead of ensure that people could register to vote. You know, one of the issues, a lot that, again, this is sort of the effort to prove up this right-wing narrative that turns out not to be based in fact. The right-wingers who had criticized the Civil Rights Division for years had said, well, look, they're just a bunch of racists. They're a bunch of reverse racists at the Justice Department, because they'll only go after white people who discriminate against black people in voting, but they won't go against black people who discriminate against white people in voting. And so that led to this effort, this sort of Moby Dick effort, to go out and find some case where black public officials had discriminated against white voters and bring a Voting Rights Act case against them. And, you know, they worked really hard and they devoted a lot of resources, and they found this one case in Mississippi that they tried to death and, you know, eventually proved voting rights violation there. Meanwhile, there's all this other voting discrimination that they let go by the wayside. You know, even a conservative Supreme Court said, how could you have allowed this voting discrimination against Latino voters in Texas to get past you? I mean, you know, even a conservative Supreme Court found that they just hadn't done enough on the kind of traditional voting rights enforcement. And the reason for that is because they were out looking to try to prove up these right-wing narratives. And, you know, I think the concern now is, you know, they all know, the folks who are coming in with the Trump administration know exactly where all the bodies are buried. They know exactly what they need to do, and they can get right on subverting the Civil Rights Division again.
How many of the legacy Bush people, because I've heard people say, I mean, during the second term of the Bush administration, I remember the idea being that it's going to take like 12 years to sort of flush the system of the damage and the personnel who were still interested in doing damage from the system. We didn't get to 12 years. We got to 8 years. How many of those people that the Bush administration put into in this particular department are still there and are just like, finally, you know, here's my balloon payment, essentially. how many of those remain? I just want to talk about the different legacies and how many of the people that Tom Perez put in, and then his successors, Samuels and Gupta, put in to the Civil Rights Division. How many will go forward, do you think? And do they have, and these are two very distinct questions, but do these people have a distinct mission of like, we're now, you know, we're now the partisans, you know, hiding in the woods, more or less?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I think on the first question, I think by the end of the Obama administration, there certainly are still people who were hired during the George W. Bush administration who remain at the Civil Rights Division. I think that for the most part, those are the lawyers who came in during the Bush administration, but, you know, actually were good, effective lawyers who, you know, were willing to appropriately follow what the new administration wants. I mean, you know, it is true that elections matter in this country. We have an executive branch where the president comes in, gets to appoint his political people, and they get to make certain decisions about how to allocate resources. And we can criticize those decisions, but there's not an illegitimacy to the fact that they're making those decisions. And, you know, I think there are some lawyers who will still be there who will now do what their new supervisors want. But who are basically good lawyers. I think the ones, the sort of fifth columnists, the people who are actively working to undermine civil rights enforcement, I think after a while they realized it just wasn't that fun to be working the Civil Rights Division anymore. Many of them found, you know, very nice sinecures in the right-wing media or other organizations. A lot of them, I expect, will come back now. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, you know, I think the legacy, the sort of toxic legacy of the George W. Bush administration, that required a lot of work. But I think that Tom Perez and his successors really worked through that. Now, you know, the question is, well, what about all the new people who were hired? Because a lot of people have been hired in the last 8 years. You know, when the Democrats controlled Congress, there was a very big hiring boost in the first couple of years of the Obama administration. And of course, there's been turnover in the period since. I obviously talk to a lot of people who are still there. I have a lot of friends in the division. You know, I my sense of the people who are there is they're working to be able to do their work. You know, to be able to continue to enforce the civil rights laws. You know, I don't think they're going to be out to act as some kind of internal resistance. You know, they want to enforce the laws. If the new administration says we want to prioritize this set of civil rights laws or this set of civil rights cases rather than another, I think they'll probably do that. I think the concern is that the folks who are perceived as being liberal, who are perceived as being civil rights advocates, who are among the career staff will be targeted for retaliation. That's what happened in the George W. Bush administration. People who had come in during the Clinton administration, people who were understood as being close to the political appointees in the Clinton administration, people who had a particular profile as being aggressive civil rights advocates, those are folks who got, you know, these transfers without warning to do nothing jobs. A lot of the lawyers in the Civil Rights Division were actually reassigned to handle deportation cases, to kick people out of the country, you know, which is like you want to make a civil rights lawyer's life hell. Like that's a thing to do. Tell them you're going to get up every day and you're going to kick people out of this country. And there was a point to that, right? And the point to that was to try to drive people out. And I expect we'll see that again.
I mean, do you have a sense of, are there maybe this is something that you wouldn't be able to tell, but are there like secret like fight clubs where we're going to get together as support groups and we're just going to say like, we're all going to try and hang in here for 4 years? Because if I'm on that deportation desk, you know, my mm-hmm. pen's a lot slower than it used to be, that type of thing.
You know, I think that people are going to do their jobs. I think that people have very individual decisions to make, though, you know, and I think everybody has his or her own individual degree of tolerance. You know, what is the amount that I'm willing to tolerate? And you know, I think these are really hard decisions. It's obviously really important for the enforcement of civil rights laws, for the good people who are in career positions who went there to carry out the laws that Congress passed, to stay there to try to fight for what, you know, to fight for those laws. Again, this is not their own personal political views. I mean, these are laws that were passed by Congress, that were signed by the president. They're a part of the U.S. Code. They're a part of the Constitution. They're important, and they're recognized as important beyond just some individual person's conscience. But look, I mean, at some point it becomes too hard and people will leave. Some people can't leave. You know, some people will find that there's no other job they can get that's a job that kind of fits their lives the way they need it to. But, you know, if it's too intolerable for too long, then a lot of people will leave.
And I imagine, I mean, the thing that's interesting about the Department of Justice, it strikes me, is that unlike, let's say, the EPA, for instance, although I guess you might have think tanks where there are people sitting on, you know, the air quotes environmental desk at the Heritage Foundation. I don't know what that would look like. Mm-hmm. But there is a machine that is turning out lawyers, the Federalist Society, right? I mean, there is a machine on the legal side that doesn't exist when you think about like the Department of Education, let's say, or the EPA, or the Department of Energy, where there is like, you know, trainees in that field who are there specifically to counteract the expansive legislation that has been passed over the past, I don't know, 50 years. And so I would imagine it's relative, you know, as much as we want to draw an analogy, and there's some things that are similar, this is more extreme than, at least in terms of like the civil service personnel, because at the EPA, it's like, we're going to find one of those pro-fracking environmentalists. We'll find some, but we're not going to find that many, right? Because they've been making money in the fracking industry.
Right. Right. No, I think that's right. I think that in the legal world, you have this, you know, very ideological group of people who are trained up from their first days in law school to be part of an ideological community. And, you know, with institutions like the Federalist Society, you know, and there are some institutions on the left half of the political spectrum, too, like the American Constitution Society and others that try to serve as a counterweight. But I think what that does mean is in the legal world in particular, there's this ready-made group of people who have been spending a lot of time developing kind of a counter-narrative of what the government agency at issue should do. And certainly you see that in the Civil Rights Division. I mean, there's no artifice to this, right? This is not something that's a hidden secret plan. I mean, all you have to do is, you know, read what comes out of the Heritage Foundation, read PJ Media, read the folks on the right. They're telling you exactly what's going to happen.
Oh, God. You're the first guest I think we've ever had on this program to say the words, read PJ Media.
Well, you know.
I know, I understand. So, all right, let's go through some of these areas where you think it's going to be the most damaging. I mean, obviously, voting rights are up there. And I should remind people that John Roberts, who presided over the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by essentially blowing up the pre-clearance formula, got his start, or maybe it wasn't quite his start, but that was a 30-year trajectory, right? I mean, he was in the Civil Rights Division under Reagan.
Well, he was in the Attorney General's office under Reagan, and civil rights was one of his areas. And yes, he you know, became very famous when he got nominated to the Supreme Court. Had written a number of memos opposing the extension of the Voting Rights Act in 1982, and you know, which is and then obviously he had the chance as the Chief Justice to write the opinion and be the fifth vote for the court in. Really, as John Lewis said, ripping the heart out of the Voting Rights Act, the preclearance provisions. But, you know, there's still a number of other parts of the voting rights apparatus, including the Voting Rights Act, that have been used in the Obama administration to attack restrictive voter ID laws, to attack various other vote suppression laws. And, you know, best case scenario is the new administration comes in and just shuts that litigation down, just says we're not going to participate in this litigation anymore. You know, NAACP, ACLU, all the rest of you, you continue it, but we're not going to participate. But that's like the best case scenario. The problem is there are a number of legal tools that a new administration will have to actually turn the Civil Rights Division in favor of vote suppression, to use voting rights litigation as an instrument of vote suppression. So, one of the statutes I talk about in my article is the National Voter Registration Act, which people call the motor voter law because it's the law that says you get registered to vote when you get a driver's license. It has a provision. It was part of a compromise. It has a provision that says that states have to make efforts to keep their voter rolls current. And on the right, you've heard a consistent drumbeat now for over a decade that the voting rolls in big cities are too bloated. There are people who are on those rolls who don't live there anymore, maybe don't live anywhere anymore, maybe they're dead, maybe they moved away, and that what the Justice Department ought to do is bring suits against those cities to force those cities and those states where those cities are to knock people off the voting rolls, right? I would really worry that a new civil rights division under Trump and under Jeff Sessions, who has his own history with voting rights law, are going to go and really use this tool as a way to knock people off the voting rolls and make it harder for people to vote. You know, and there's sort of issues like that on down the line. But just that's
explain,
a real concern.
So, for instance, okay, so they go to Milwaukee, let's say, and they say, you know, we've randomly sampled 2,000 people on your voting roll, and we found an incidence of, I don't know, 1%, 2% of dead people. What can they do at that point to Milwaukee? They say, like, you need to institute a program where you send a letter to the House, and if you don't hear anything back in a week, you've got to eliminate them for the voting. I mean, that's a little bit extreme, but is that the type of thing that they could theoretically do?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're thinking about it in sort of the right general way, right? So they could. So this is a piece of the law that is very unclearly written, which unfortunately creates a lot of opportunity for mischief. With the right kind of judge, right meaning right wing kind of judge, they could go in and get an order against a city or against a state, saying unless people do a lot of things to let you know that they're still there, you have to knock them off the voting rolls. And you know, we know both from the way voting behavior works and from the way bureaucracies work that there are going to be a lot of people who are on the voting rolls who actually are registered voters, but you know, may not vote all the time, and who will end up getting knocked off the rolls. And when they go to try to vote at a later election, they're going to get a nasty surprise, which is that they're not eligible to vote.
Right.
And so that's one of the real concerns.
Let's talk about fair housing. How do you perceive the Trump administration might go after the concept of fair housing? What has the Civil Rights Division been doing in terms of housing?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, obviously Trump is a person who personally has a lot of experience with fair housing as a defendant in a lawsuit brought by the Justice Department in the Nixon administration, saying that he had discriminated in apartments that he ran against black applicants for tenancy. So, and I don't think he thinks of it as a particularly fond experience.
They had to issue a second consent decree, didn't they, or something?
Yeah, I mean, so he entered into a consent decree and then violated the consent decree, and they had to bring another suit, essentially, or another action to enforce that consent decree. The facts in the case were pretty egregious, right? The folks who took tenancy applications had to write the letter C on applications to indicate that the person was black, a C for colored. This is, you know, in the 1970s. We have every reason to believe that the idea of aggressive fair housing enforcement is not something the Trump administration is going to be that in favor of. The Obama administration took a number of steps to try to bring systemic cases. So there are all these individual cases of fair housing violations that pretty much every Justice Department will bring. You know, so if there's one applicant for a lease who gets turned down, and the evidence indicates it's because of their race, the Justice Department's going to bring that case. The real shift in the Obama administration was to try to do this on a wholesale rather than a retail level, to try to bring big systemic cases, to try to take action like the rule that the Department of Housing and Urban Development issued that required cities to engage in actions affirmatively furthering fair housing and states to engage in actions affirmatively furthering fair housing, which is a requirement of the law that had really fallen into disuse. Now, both Trump and his nominee for Secretary of HUD have criticized this. The nominee, Ben Carson, has said it's social engineering to try to force people to move, you know, force suburbs to take people who they don't want to take. I think you can see a lot of that getting shut down. A lot of the work in the early Obama administration dealt with lending discrimination, particularly arising out of the foreclosure crisis. We found that in a lot of the places hardest hit by foreclosures, banks were giving less favorable loan terms to minority borrowers. And you know, whether that was intentional discrimination or whether that was application of a formula that didn't actually serve bottom line interests but did a good job of really sticking it to minority borrowers, we don't know, but what we do know is that meant that blacks and Hispanics were especially hard hit by the foreclosure crisis in a lot of places. And you know, I have every reason to believe that that work is just done under a Trump administration. And you know, that was, you know, we're talking about multi-million dollar settlements for people who were injured by bank discrimination in the foreclosure crisis. So I think that that's all going to be a very big change in the housing area.
I want to encourage people to go check out your piece to talk about the other areas. I don't know if there's one other area that particularly seems uniquely problematic to you.
Yeah, I mean, I would say police. Right. So one of the big efforts of the Obama administration was to take this authority that the Civil Rights Division had had ever since the mid-90s but hadn't really used that aggressively and try to take on patterns or practices of police misconduct, of police officers violating the Constitution. This happened even before the Black Lives Matter movement brought such attention to that. But, you know, it was a real agenda item of Tom Perez when he was head of the Civil Rights Division before he went to the Labor Department. And, you know, Trump ran on the platform that we're going to end what he called the war on cops. A lot of people in the law enforcement community and in the Trump inner circle have blamed the Justice Department's actions in enforcing civil rights laws against police departments for what they've called the war on cops. I think that's, you know, going to be another one of these huge swings from the Obama administration to the Trump administration.
So I want to just. And again, encourage people to go read your piece at theprospect.org. I mean, on some level, the American Prospect, on some level, you know, I feel like we should have had this interview 8 months ago so that people could sort of appreciate. I mean, I think, you know, that is the problem that we have. I think, you know, throughout the left on some level, we like the idea of government doing these things. But we're not totally keyed into them, and perhaps maybe there was some institutional memory of what happened last time a Republican administration got in. Never mind one that is seems to be so determined to unwind so much. And I want to just turn though for a moment because I had this question, and this is another area that's not necessarily in your portfolio, but the Department of Labor had issued a couple of months ago an overtime rule that was expanding overtime for millions of Americans, meaning that if you got paid at a certain higher level you would be eligible for overtime. That overtime rule was enjoined, in my understanding, by an Eastern District Texas court in, I guess, just a month ago or so, late November. Mm-hmm. A listener asked a couple of questions that I couldn't answer, and I thought maybe you could. They thought it was strange that the Obama Department of Labor appealed the decision but asked for an expedited briefing schedule where the Department of Labor's reply brief is due February 7th of 2017, because obviously that would not be under the Obama administration. It would be under the Trump administration. And they didn't move to stay the lower court's opinion, which would have delayed the enforcement, meaning the rules couldn't go into effect until the Circuit Court of Appeals ruled. Does that strike you as odd? Is it, or I mean, what are the chances of this overtime rule existing 3 months from now, based upon what I think we can all speculate the Department of Labor is going to be like under Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I think the chances are very low that this rule is going to exist 3 months from now, and I think it's a very astute question, but the Department of Labor is in a really difficult situation, right? So here you have an example of actually the rule as a matter of administrative law and employment law. There's really no problem with it. It's not something that I think anyone who is a serious lawyer would have thought would have been a problem, but for the fact that we have a legal system now where states, you know, shop all around the country and find judges who are extreme outliers, and you know, often they've found those judges in Texas, and they get these nationwide injunctions against the actions of the Obama administration, which then get appealed to a very conservative court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Whether the Obama administration had sought a stay in the Fifth Circuit or not, it was very unlikely that was going to be granted. This really is just a success of a conservative strategy of throwing up as much as possible to delay. I think if the Obama administration, you know, had been succeeded by a Clinton administration, they could have defended this, continued to defend it all the way to the Supreme Court. I actually think the Supreme Court would have had a hard time saying that that this overtime rule was unlawful. I think the Supreme Court would have upheld it. But you know, now a Trump administration will probably withdraw the rule or not defend it. There's always the Congressional Review Act, which would allow Congress through an expedited process to get rid of it, and President Trump would sign that bill, which is obviously something President Clinton would have vetoed. So, you know, I think realistically, it's just sort of checkmate. I mean, there's just no way out of this. There's so many ways in which the walls are closing in, and that's unfortunate, but it's another effect of the election.
Like I say, wouldn't have had the same measure of drama, I guess, to talk about these things months ago, but
yeah.
So next time around, live and learn, I guess, on some level. But Sam Bagginstos, yeah, indeed, from the professor of law, University of Michigan. The piece is "Civil Rights Deja Vu, Only Worse." It is in the American Prospect. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half. I got to say that when I read this piece and I booked it, and I am struggling with, I don't want to get people too depressed. But we need to be aware of, and, you know, obviously, our reach is not quite to 65 million people yet on this program. But broadly speaking, we need people to be aware of what our government is doing. And in this instance, what our government did and used to do, so that we can have a sense of some type of watersheds to measure when we're at low tide, as it were, in terms of what the government is doing. And really, I mean, I don't know, there isn't an apt metaphor, for, you know, at least with the tides, because the tides are never, they go, they ebb and flow, but there's nobody actively working to drive the tide lower, right? I mean, and that's what we're going to see here. We're going to see these agencies weaponized to fight against the premise of the agency. And so we're going to see at the EPA an attorney, former attorney general, whose expertise was arguing against the statutory authority of the EPA to do what it was doing. And Sam had mentioned that you're going to see like the NAACP and the ACLU bringing suits against states for violating the Voting Rights Act. And in some instances, the Department of Justice could end up fighting those suits, those civil suits. Certainly at the EPA, we're going to see states and individuals suing the EPA for not doing their job as prescribed by law. And the EPA now has an expert at the head of it who is an expert in arguing why the law does not compel the EPA to do things like keep the air clean, keep the water clean. And this dynamic we're going to see play out in agency after agency. And so we need these foundations. I mean, you know, this is really the only way that we can, you know, we can fight back. It's just not enough to talk about Donald Trump's hair plugs and his orange hue and the fact that, you know, his sons are monetizing. I mean, God knows. God knows what they... I'll tell you what is... I don't know that the sons monetizing this stuff is the least of our worries because...
I was thinking more of the orange face.
The orange thing. Face.
Yeah.
But... And we're going to talk about the you know...
We'll talk about the orange face, too.
The klepto watch. No, we're going to talk about the orange face, of course. But the kleptocracy stuff, which is different from this sort of... assault on our government agencies and our laws. The kleptocracy stuff, what's problematic about that is that's how you slip into an authoritarian regime. Because once there is an understanding by business people, and I'm not saying all business people, right? Hashtag not all business people. But for people whose fundamental belief is to accumulate as much money regardless of what the laws are, what the norms are, whatnot. And we know there's a lot of them. One of them is president of the United States, or is going to be in a month. And we know there's a lot of them. I mean, that's if there wasn't, the Republican Party would be even smaller. But once word gets out, and word is getting out, that like, look, you know, you really need and to kiss the administration's ass. And it's effective, right? Like there's nobody in there who is going to say like, hey, wait a second. These guys are my friends, but the law is the law. That's not the way it's going to work. That's where you start to slip into these authoritarian scenarios where it gets really, really ugly. And people in these agencies see it too. I mean, it's not like you can be working in the civil rights division of the Department of Justice or at the EPA or somewhere else and not be subject to audits because you were writing about Trump so much. All this, you know, is going to be important stuff for people to really have clarity so that we can see what's going on and react to it quickly. And that reaction may be just, you know, talking about it with your coworkers or, you know, this is, you know, slipping into dark areas, it seems to me it's pretty easy. I was walking with a guy from Saul's school today, and we were talking about this, and he said, you know, humans have a real capacity to adjust very quickly. You smell vinegar, it smells horrible, but they've done tests, and like after a half an hour, you can barely smell it.
Right?
There you go.
Am I right? Yeah, just adjust. People are adaptable. It's
sit
amazing.
Down. Smell your bowl of vinegar.
Smell the bowl of vinegar. You like it. Pretty soon it'll smell like persimmons.
We're just going to sit here until you can't smell the vinegar, and then we're going to start to talk.
Kick back, have a brew, Stein 2020.
All right, we're going to take a quick break.
This is head really good for the left.
Fun half. Where did I do with my... Oh, here is... I get. Oh, we got some fun sound for you. Oh, yeah. This dude, Representative Bill Huizinga, from Republican from Zeeland, Michigan. Oh, God. He's got some great, funny stuff about healthcare that we're going to talk about. And Scott Brown's daughter... Isla Brown sits down.
Scott Brown's daughter.
All right. We're going to take a quick break.
Incest is a theme.
6462. Oh, let me just a little house cleaning. So here's what's going to happen. We're doing a live show tomorrow. We're doing a live show Thursday. We're doing a pre-tape of our final show of the year on for Friday. So our last live show is Thursday. Jimmy Reefer Cake, if you're out there and you want us to put the song in, if you have a year-end song, got to get it to us by tomorrow afternoon. Got to do it. We'll be taking phone calls, basically going to open it up on Thursday. We'll take phone calls throughout the whole show, IMs. It'll be our 2016 goodbye. All next week, we have best ofs. If you have any suggestions for the best ofs, send them in today or when you hear this. And write in the subject line at majorityreporters@gmail.com, best of. Also, if you want to become a member of the program, today's the day to do it. I mean, tomorrow is tomorrow too, but whenever you hear this, today is the day to do it. Join themajorityreport.com. It is your membership that makes the show possible. Want to give a gift of the Majority Report? We've had a lot of people gifting. Not only does every time you give a gift to the Majority Report, does an angel get its wings, but you also, Kyle Shank's smile on his face goes up just like a millimeter, because he developed this system via fans.fm, and it's a great system. All you got to do is go to majoritygift.com. If you have one of the legacy URLs, you can use those, like Cuck Nation, I think it is, but .org. You don't want to go to. You certainly don't want to go to cucknation.com. But if you go to majoritygift.com, you can give the gift of the Majority Report to a friend, to your kids, to your grandkids, to your husband, to your wife, to your in-laws. Like, I may just gift the Majority Report to my in-laws just because I'm, you know, agitated with them.
Hello, in-laws. Here are my thoughts on you and what you think. This whole show is an indirect passive-aggressive attack on my wife's family, which has motivated all of my greatest work.
So there you have it. And that can be you. That can be you. You can have me be your passive-aggressive attack on your family if you want. So... go to majoritygift.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon or from jet.com, do so via our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Quick break, right back, 646-257-3920. We'll turn the IMO on as well.